Lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land.
Throws across his body, and he got it! Looking to wave McCann around third. Throw from the outfield is up the line, inside the park, home run! Deep, gone! Whoa! Up and he makes a catch up against the wall, and he's gonna watch it fly. Strike three called. He got him on strikes.
Welcome to The Voice of the Turtle, a podcast feature of West of Woodward, online at westofwoodward.com and also on Twitter at hookslide23. I'm your host, Hookslide, along with my co-host, Rob Rojacki, of course, the co-managing editor at blessyouboys.com, contributing writer to beyondtheboxscore.com. And Rob, are you prepared for this final stretch of Tigers baseball games?
I actually am. I kind of went through a dead period for a little while there where I was kind of, I guess, not feeling it or whatever. You know, a little bit of burnout. It's a long season. But no, I'm actually kind of fired up and excited to watch this team for a little while now.
All right. So on that note, I'm going to leave and you can take over the show and let me know how it turns out.
I mean, it's going to be quick, but.
Okay. We do have an episode, actually. We have kind of a full episode this week, so let's get to it. Things are getting dire in Tiger Town. Inconsistency reigns supreme. An upcoming easy schedule suddenly doesn't look quite as easy. The Tigers could still snag a wild card spot, or are we looking at another long off season? We've got notes on next year's schedule. We're going to talk about some possible changes in MLB rules. We'll take some listener questions, and then we'll wrap up with a discussion on what to do or not do with Victor Martinez. So let's get it started. Let's round the bases. Just win, Tigers. Just win. We'll see you after the break.
Fly ball here to center. Way back in center. Deep. Gone. Whoa, man. Straight away center to the camera well. Three runs shot for Cabrera. As far as you'll see one hit here at Comerica Park. And the Tigers take a 3-0.
And so here we go. Rob, let's just get this thing kicked right off. I'm kind of in a cranky mood just after having actively participated in the last week of Tigers baseball, watching some games, drove to Cleveland to see a game. And, you know, we've talked for so long, the last 2 weeks at least, about how this part of the schedule was supposed to be the easy part, playing the White Sox, playing the Twins, to a certain extent even playing the Royals, all leading up to that big showdown in Cleveland. And instead, what happens is, and instead of them getting ahead of, you know, this big eight ball that they're behind, they end up splitting that stupid series with the Twins, which is not what they needed to do. And then they go and lose 2 of 3 in Cleveland. Out of those two, which is more frustrating to you, the fact that they end up splitting with the Twins or that they lose to the Indians yet again?
If anything, it's almost like the Indian series was a little bit more frustrating just because of how things transpired. You know, obviously you kind of expect to lose to Corey Kluber on Friday night, but with Carlos Carrasco leaving the game in what, the top of the first inning after 2 pitches, and then to get shut out by their bullpen for 10 innings, not even 9, 10 innings. That was definitely a little bit frustrating. I didn't watch that game, and so it wasn't quite as frustrating for me, but still seeing that result happen at the end was definitely kind of one that you'll think the Tigers let one get away from them. But again, the split with the Twins, also frustrating because, you know, you have a chance to win some of those games. Maybe not necessarily the one that Matt Boyd kind of goofed up. I think it was on Tuesday, that
right,
game that they,
right,
they had that.
He crapped the bed big time.
He wasn't great, but the frustrating part was that the offense just didn't show up in a couple of these games either.
Exactly.
Like, you had a point, what was it, like 3-4-0 or something, where the Tigers could have kind of conceivably come back, but the offense just does nothing. And then the final score obviously looks a little bit worse than what it was, but there was still a game for, it was still a game for part of that. Part of that night, and the Tigers just couldn't do anything with the Twins pitching staff.
You know, I get that offenses struggle. They can be streaky. They can be up and down and so on and so forth. But I can't even recall now who exactly the 4 Twins pitchers that they faced in that series, because the Twins pitchers to me are all the same. They're all basically crap, right? Whether it's, you know, Phil Hughes or not Santana. Who's the other guy I'm thinking of? Kyle Gibson.
Yeah, generic white guy.
Generic, you know, fastball, sinkerball, Mike Pelfrey type kind of. Mike Pelfrey came right out of that. Like, he fit that profile, fit right into that rotation. But anyway, the fact that they could not get the offense going against those kind of guys just, it still baffles me.
It does, and they've gotten going against them before. I think they hit Kyle Gibson for what, like 6 runs or something like that when they had last faced him. They've had their struggles with Ervin Santana before, and Hector Santiago, a new acquisition by the Twins, they've struggled with him in the past too. But some of these other guys, they've hit around before, and it's just frustrating to see the offense go through this, you know, kind of go through this slow period right now where the team needs to score runs the most. They went, I think it was 6-9 over a 2-week stretch from the start of a White Sox series, through that series with Baltimore and then Minnesota and then against Cleveland. I think they were 6-9 during that stretch. Didn't win any of those series. Luckily, only dropped like a game or two in the wild card standings, but they definitely could have made up a lot of ground there against some weak competition.
Well, I mean, thankfully, yeah, the rest of their competition in the wild card race is kind of obliging at the same time. I know the Blue Jays have been going through a real rough stretch. The Orioles have been kind of a little bit on the slow fade there as well. But, you know, it's like I've been saying for the last several months, the Tigers at some point have to get out of just spin the wheels mode and actually make up some ground and go for it. And they've had multiple opportunities. Let's go to the Cleveland series real quick, because talk about game one and then game two. Game one, yeah, they got blown out. But there were so many points in that game that I felt like, holy crap, it's not even a joke anymore. The voodoo curse is real.
It really kind of was. I mean, you had Michael Fulmer struggling a little bit in that game. He gave up, a couple runs in the first inning. And then the next inning that they scored, he was either the second or the third. I'm blanking on which one it was. All those hits were like those, you know, kind of Minnesota Twins variety where they're like just barely getting by infielders. It wasn't really like a lot of hard hit stuff at that point. And then he kind of gives up the bomb to Napoli, I think, in the inning following that. And, you know, it was kind of over after that. But, no,
I mean,
definitely.
I'm talking not just the seeing eye singles, but Justin Upton losing a ball, utterly, completely losing it in the lights. Mm-hmm. The weirdness of the Bruce Rondon balk that, you know, sent the runner to
second
base.
Yeah, okay, so no, those, I mean, come on.
There were just so many of those little things, and never once did the Indians fail to capitalize when those things happened. It's like, okay, crack, 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 here's 3 more singles, and we're scoring those runs.
And the balk rule is just, it's utter crap at this point. Like, when is it they're actually, like, I get, like, the purpose of the balk rule is to, like, prevent pitchers from, like, trying to deke runners into going and then like stepping off and throwing at them.
Right.
And like none of the ones that get called are actually that. It's like the pitcher barely flinches. The runner doesn't move at all. No one really knows what's going on. And that's the balk call. Whereas like something that's like actually a balk, not always called.
Yeah, no, and I talk about the fact that I'm coaching in Little League this year for the first year where the kids can actually start to lead off. We have to pay attention to things like balks and learning how to read a pickoff move and, you know, telling our pitchers how to make a pickoff move without getting called on the balk, because unfortunately at this age, umpires in these leagues love to bust these kids left and right. They just feel like it's their job to teach them a lesson. So they're constantly, so like I'm a little more attuned to it. But you're right. The silly intricacies of the balk rules are so stupid. This rule that if you're going to turn and spin and throw to second, you have to come off the rubber before you separate the hands. Because if you separate the hands and the foot's still on the rubber, then apparently you're making motion to the plate. I'm like, come on. Come the F on.
I mean, it was like a split second thing. You had to go back in like slow motion to see it.
And they can't review those things, can they?
No.
No. No,
I mean, yeah, it's frustrating, and it's definitely not. You know, the Bucs were definitely weren't the reason they lost by 7 runs in that game. But
no, it was just one more
way
thing. You know, it was just one more thing that you feel like, God, you've got to be kidding with all the breaks that are going the Indians' way. And like I said, they never fail to capitalize, which in itself is odd because if you talk about the whole idea of cluster luck and stringing together base hits in order to score runs, it's very rare for it to happen just like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to have Justin Upton lose a ball in the lights and then for them to not fail to score the run after that, it just felt inevitable at that point. After Saturday's...
Well, I mean, part of it...
Go ahead.
Yeah, we had talked about this last week a little bit about, you know, other teams' ability to run the bases and steal bases. For one thing, I was shocked I think they said that the Indians lead the league in stolen bases. Did not expect that one at all. You'd think it'd be like, I think the Astros led the league last year, something like that, you know, with Jose Altuve stealing
Roger Davis
upwards of almost 50 bases. Yeah.
Roger Davis leads the league and doesn't play every day. That's what's going on over there.
Well, I mean, I think that's part of it. I think he has more license to run this year than like last year when he off part of the time and hitting in front of Miguel Cabrera and those guys. I think the Tigers don't necessarily want them running, and for good reason. This team has really kind of been running with abandon, and they have some good base runners on their team. The whole reason that the Upton ground rule double that we've been talking about allowed a second run to score is because Lindor stole second base right before that, and then the ground rule double happens. Like, if Lindor's still on first base, he's only at third after that ground rule double, and the Tigers actually catch a break with that. But no, he stole second base, and look what happens.
So if it felt cursed on Friday, Saturday just felt like the final nail in the coffin, at least as far as I was concerned. I think that's when I kind of mentally checked out on the season because, as we said, they literally knocked out Carlos Carrasco in the first two pitches. And at that point, you're feeling, yes, bad for him, but also like, hey, they're going to mash now because the Indians have to get through an entire 9-inning game with just their bullpen. And I know they've got a decent back end, but come on, they're not stacked, right?
Nobody's middle relief core is built to handle 9-plus innings in a single game.
And you know what happened?
What
happened? Terry Francona managed the shit out of that. And yeah. I was so curious to see, sitting there watching this live, kind of going, okay, well, let's see what the guy who is allegedly kind of into sabermetrics, let's see how he handles this situation. And he brought Manship in and let him face like four batters, and then he was gone. And I was like, whoa, what? I figured he'd want to let somebody go for, you know, a couple, two, three innings, fill the time. He took the bat out of Jared Saltzman-Lockie's hand the first time he came up by bringing in a lefty and switching him around from his weaker right-hand side. Same with Romine. I was like, oh my God, he's playing to win. He's not playing to fill innings. He's playing to beat these guys.
Well, and he's able to do that because of the expanded rosters. You know, sure. I don't know how many exactly relievers the Indians have on their roster right now, but that's not something you could do with a normal 25-man roster. He's definitely trying to eat two, three innings with Manship in any other month other than September.
It was just an odd, I guess it immediately felt like that. Like I said, like, he's not just trying to survive this game. He's going for it. He thinks he can actually win this with his bullpen. And sure enough, he did. And I think he outmatched Osmus point for point, the whole little double, not a double switch. But kind of, what did the one guy in the stands tell me? He rope-a-doped Osmus. At that one point in the game where they walked Almonte to get to Perez, Francona brought out Alani Chisenhall to the on-deck circle. But I don't think he ever had any intention of letting Chisenhall bat. For one thing, Bruce Rondon's better this year against lefties anyway. But for the other thing, Chisenhall just spent like 4 days on the disabled list with a groin strain or an abdominal muscle strain. But as soon as he came out, Osmus responded, ran right out there, pulled Rondon, who was doing fine, and brought in Justin Wilson. And just like that, Francona turns and counters with Brandon Guyer, who is destroying left-handed pitching this year. And it just felt like, oh my God, this is okay. Brad Osmus is Wile E. Coyote and Francona is the Roadrunner, and just like put up a stack of birdseed with a sign that said free lefty-lefty matchup. And then Brad Osmus got hit on the head with an anvil. And so it was so evident like that one of these guys is not on the same level as the other. Now it worked out. Guyer grounded out, but still the way it played out was like, oh my God.
That is a perfect analogy.
I think that is exactly.
I feel like you've been thinking of that for like 3 days now.
No, I've been thinking a lot of bad things, but that one just popped. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, and Justin Wilson, like, what's going on with him? I feel like there's going to be some sort of thing that comes out at the end of the season where they talk about, you know, his elbow was doing this, or he even has like surgery to do something, because I feel like the elbow is really kind of the reason why he's having all these difficulties right now. I don't know what his velocities looked like in his last couple outings, but it was down at one point. He's definitely not striking out batters the way he was earlier in the year. We've talked about this a little bit before, but I feel like there's going to be something that comes out about that elbow at the end of the season.
Well, I'll say this. At least it was nice to get to see Justin Verlander put on a clinic, you know, and a one hit, what, seven innings, one hit, no runs. It was really cool to see him do his thing. He definitely looked to me in the early stages of that game that he did not have his secondary stuff.
He walked like four guys, didn't he?
He did. He was missing with the slider, the curve, and then he just finally was like, screw it, and went back to like 97-mile-an-hour fastballs, which I'm not used to seeing that till like the sixth, seventh inning for him. To see him bust that out in the second or third inning was just like, it reeked of him making the adjustment right then and there. Like, okay, you can't hit the fastball, so I guess I'm just going to have to do that. And eventually he got his secondary stuff back, you know, towards the end of the game, thankfully, because I'm not sure he could have spent that much in the tank, but yeah, that was at least a plus from watching that game. But yeah, I'd go 10 innings against the Cleveland bullpen and still not be able to not even score one single run. And by the time Andrew Miller came into the game, it was like, yeah, screw it. It's over. That dude is filthy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, filthy from the where we were sitting kind of behind home plate. I've seen Aroldis Chapman pitch.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Miller's fastball looks 1,000 times faster.
Really?
Because he's all like arms and legs.
You know? He's got the longest legs.
He has such fucking long legs. And when he goes, like, he stretches out that arm when he throws, and his fingers are 4 inches from the plate when he releases.
Mm-hmm.
It was so, I mean, it was fun to watch, kind of, sort of. I mean,
mm-hmm.
not the end result.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not necessarily going to complain about sending him away in the trade that brought Miguel Cabrera to Detroit. But at the same time, it would have been kind of cool to see what he could have done as a starter with, like, proper seasoning in the minors in the Tiger system.
Who knows? Who knows that, you know, he's one of these guys that once he got to the pen, he could really just air it all out or whatever. But that slider is devastatingly just ugh. He dismantled Miguel Cabrera in one of those at-bats, and even Miggy was, like, kind of looking out at him like, well, okay. Like, what can you do? Unreal. But they got away with at least one win.
Was actually kind of a big win in the series. To be able to take that game, I think they picked up a game on Toronto with that win on Sunday to salvage a game in the series and then, you know, kind of get that going forward into this week now, where I think they interplay on Tuesday with like a 2.5-game deficit on both Baltimore and Toronto. And then I think Baltimore is losing right now. And so if the Tigers can win tonight, they could be, you know, as close as 1.5 back.
Well, then they'll keep hope alive, and I'll have to re-engage, I guess, even though I don't really want to, because, like I said, after those two games in Cleveland, it just felt like, yeah, it's... And of course, because it's baseball, of course, the games they lose are the ones that Fulmer and Verlander start, and the one that they win is the one that Daniel Norris starts, because baseball, right?
I mean, Daniel Norris has been pretty filthy lately.
He has been very good. How many did he strike out in that game on Sunday?
6 or 7.
Yeah, I thought it was up there. The game before that, he had struck out something like 6 or 7 as well. So he's...
Yeah. Well, no, in September, I was actually writing a post on this today. It hasn't been published yet, but I'm hoping to get it up probably tomorrow. He's struck out almost 35% of the batters he's faced in September. It's only been 3 starts, but 35% strikeout rate.
Hot damn.
And a lot of it is coming on the fastball right now. He's really spotting it well, getting it up in the zone, and guys just can't catch up to it. He's really – the command is taking a step forward, too. I think he's only walked like 4 guys in his last 3 starts.
Wow.
And even going back to like August 1st, his walk rate has been pretty good. And so I think it's kind of funny, though, that like this good stretch corresponds with like his longest healthy stretch in a Tigers uniform, and I think there's definitely something to that.
Yeah, and like you said, the fact that he's able to kind of find the command a little bit. I mean, we saw him pitch for us last year, but like you just alluded to, he was injured. There wasn't really a consistent stretch of, you know, get in there, work through this, you know, get some experience under your belt. He kind of got interrupted this year, but now he's back into it. And the longer he goes, the more he seems to kind of, you know, mature and develop into this. I'm half wondering if he'll be, you know, good enough to consider for the rotation, if not next year, certainly the year after that. But this is somebody, I think, when he finds that stride, he could have, I know what his ceiling is, you know, as a 2 or a 3, but I think he could have individual years outside of that rival anything Justin Verlander has done.
Yeah, I mean, maybe not the MVP season that Verlander had, but definitely some of the stuff that we've seen, especially from Verlander like this year, I think that Norris could get up to that level. One of the other things that I was kind of noticing with this, it's very like a very slight thing, but his slider is also looking good, and he's throwing it a little bit harder too. He's not necessarily getting up to that like Justin Verlander 90 mile per hour cutter type pitch, but he's throwing it at like 87, 88, which is a little bit harder than I think he was before. And I'd be interested to see kind of how that evolves. It seems like that's been another good pitch for him. I mean, he's really been spotting everything: the fastball, the slider, and the changeup have all been looking very good in his last 2 starts. And if he can continue to do that, yeah, the sky's the limit for him.
And so we go back to something that I pointed out on Twitter today, that if you recall, when the offseason started and we were kind of questioning how will the Tigers take care of this mess of a starting rotation that needs to be rebuilt. And the way that I think it was Al Avila said, it was him or Brad Ausmus said, you know, we are not going to go into this 2016 season with guys like Norris and Boyd, because it would be foolish to rely on rookies to get you to, you know, a pennant race. And look what's happened.
I mean, I get that. It is kind of foolish to rely on these rookies to think that they're going to get there. But when your other options are Anibal Sanchez, who was coming off a horrible 2015 season, and Mike Pelfrey, that's really the problem.
No, I cannot help but appreciate the irony of the fact that, yes, absolutely don't rely on the rookies to start the season. They made the right move in signing Zimmerman, you know, putting Sanchez. It's the way it's played out, the fact of the matter, that the veterans have hurt the team way more. And it's the kids who are carrying them down this stretch.
You know, as far as those guys go, there's really kind of a best-case scenario for the three of them this season. Obviously, Michael Fulmer has been amazing. Maybe tiring a little bit down the stretch. It's tough to say with him. We'll get to him in a minute. But with Daniel Norris and Matt Boyd doing what they're doing, I think Boyd is already kind of maybe surpassing expectations a little bit. Mm-hmm. And with Norris coming on strong late, I mean, you know, it's looking great for 2017 with those three.
Let's talk a little about Michael Fulmer, because there is that kind of that feeling, and I know some of the Tigers fan base feels that way, that when you kind of watch his last, I don't know, 3-4 starts, maybe we'll say, there does seem to be a little bit of loss of something. Not quite sure what. A sharpness that's not there. You know, the strikeouts are down just a little bit, and they weren't necessarily super high to begin with. We talked about that months ago. But is it really fatigue?
I mean, it might be. It might not. It's tough to say. It doesn't look like his velocity has changed much so far. He's still kind of pumping that mid-90s fastball in there. It'd be interesting to see, like, if his spin rate has changed on those at all, because I think that's a little bit more of a sign of its fatigue, if you can take a look at kind of that StatCast data with that. Looking at Fulmer's velocity right now, he's averaged 95.5 miles per hour on the fastball in September, and he was at like 95.6, 95.7 in August. So, you know, not really much measurable change there. I mean, you know, 0.2 on the radar gun is nothing really, especially when you get down to September. I think everyone's velocity dips a little bit in the last month of the season. And so I almost wonder if it's more just kind of the scheduling, like the getting jerked around, getting, you know, 4 days rest between one start and then like 9 days rest and then 6 days rest. He's not really getting into that same routine that a lot of starting pitchers crave. And I wonder if that's messing with him more so than like the number of innings he's thrown.
Yeah, I remember Matthew Mowry of the Oakland Press was tweeting about that some days ago, trying to kind of show what the stats were when he pitched on 4 days rest versus 5 days versus 6 days. And I think the best numbers he had were on the shortest amount of rest. And I want to say the worst numbers were when he was in like the regular 5 day rest, which is weird. But to your point, I think it is about keeping that rhythm. And if you're on and then off and then on and then off, and that I think maybe just combined with the fact that he has been pitching since April, May. At this point, you have to expect that some of the league's hitters are going to catch up, you know, start to make their own adjustments, start to see the ball a little better, hit him a little better.
Yeah, and part of it is also that, you know, he went through this amazing stretch where he's giving up, like, no runs, basically, and he was going to regress from that a little bit anyway. And so part of that natural regression, along with the league maybe figuring him out a little bit, along with kind of this, you know, herky-jerky schedule, I think is, it's all coming together at one point, you know, at the same time, and the results just haven't been there. Plus the Cleveland voodoo curse doesn't help.
Well, you know, he got beat by them twice now. And the first time we thought it was because, well, he's a rookie. It's his second big league start. You know, that's going to happen. But this time around, come on.
He had a really good start against them in the middle.
He did. That's the one game they won before, you know, this past Sunday. So
we've doubled our win total against Cleveland.
World Series, here we come. Yeah. All right, changing subjects then. Let's go on to Justin Upton. Justin Upton takes 3 days off in August, and suddenly he's Justin Upton. Although, as I wrote in a post today and showed by some using RE24 and some graphs to show the last 5 years of his career, he's not quite back to what he's been in the last couple years. He is having a nice stretch, but it's not to the level that you would expect Justin Upton to be, and it's coming kind of at the tail end. I'm wondering if that's, though, maybe cause for some hope to say maybe he's just now starting to kind of catch up and figure out American League pitching, and he's primed for having a good year next year.
Yeah, that's kind of what I had wondered a little bit with him, is that, you know, with this prolonged, if he stretched it, he's had, has it been almost like an adjustment period for him? You know, he going back the last month plus here, I'm basically cherry picking like his lowest OPS at this point. He has a 1.056 OPS in 100 or so plate appearances with 12 home runs. And so, you know, definitely a hot stretch, maybe not necessarily like as hot as he's been at certain points throughout his career, but definitely hot enough to carry this offense at times. I think he was responsible for, in that Cleveland loss we were talking about earlier, I think he was responsible for all their runs in that game with the two homers that he had.
Yeah. Yes.
And so it's sometimes just not even enough from him to be able to carry this team. But, you know, it's definitely encouraging for 2017 to see him figure this out and that it's not necessarily like an injury thing that he's going to need surgery for. If it's a longer adjustment period, I guess, you know, there's nothing you can do about that, but hope that he comes back in 2017 and starts crushing things from the start.
Well, it's definitely, you know, it's beyond dispute at this point that 2016 is one of his worst years. I think the next, year in his history where this kind of thing happened was 2011. And even then it wasn't as bad. His lows were not nearly as low as what they were this year. In between that, he's got, 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015, where he is having more of the true streaky Justin Upton version. That's, when he's hot, he's posting run expectancy totals, well above plus 10 for the month, even up to plus 15 for the month. Zero's average. If he's doing that in a month, he's killing it. This year so far, he has yet to cross even 10. His highest has been like a plus 6 run expectancy in any given month. And he's only done that twice. Every other month has been in the negative. So
what is he at in September so far?
September, he is up to like 6.7, I think. Something
Basically a 10, on pace for 10 right now. Today's what,
he
20?
He should be on pace for it. If he can keep it going, then he'll finally have like that one month this year, this season. But as I was saying, in years past, he's done that multiple months, a couple times. So the lows got really, really low. The highs didn't get quite as high. And I think that only sets us up for next year to say he's got to be, I think he'll be a pleasant surprise. If we survived Upton of 2016, we can deal with what he's going to give us in 2016.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are going to look at his last two seasons. Because if you look at his 2015 numbers, they were a little bit down as well and really kind of write him off heading into 2017. And then I think that he might be kind of poised for that almost a re-breakout where he gets back to kind of his career norms. He has a good season, maybe opts out of his contract and gets the Tigers out from underneath those last 4 years of it. We'll see on that. We're a long ways away from there.
Victor Martinez, another hot topic. I know we're going to tackle that towards the end of the show, so we'll just kind of note that that's out there, the way he's kind of been struggling. In fact, he's not even in today's lineup, if I'm not mistaken. We're recording this again Tuesday, September 20th. He's out of the lineup tonight, isn't he?
Yeah, both him and Ian Kinsler are out. And I got a notification from MLB Trade Rumors that said that Kinsler was diagnosed with a concussion. He's not necessarily like forced onto any sort of disabled list or whatever. So like, as soon as he passes the tests, he can come back. But with those things, it's anyone's guess as to how long he'll be out.
Well, he did take a 95 mile an hour fastball right off the head.
Yeah.
So that might take a little bit. That's extremely frustrating. And I know that Trevor Bauer did not intend to do that. I mean, you could tell he felt terrible about it. It's just a bad command thing.
Yeah, he
thing.
Tweeted about it after the game and apologized to the guys.
It happened, the way he went down on one knee on the mound, it was just like, oh my God, what did I do? But that's not what the fans want to hear. And then from what I'm picking up on, sports talk radio, on Twitter, fans are livid with the fact that happened.
Yeah, I mean, they want like more retribution for what happened, as if Daniel Norris throwing behind Rajay Davis wasn't enough.
And why would you throw at Rajay Davis? Well, I mean, come on. I mean, that just felt like...
Was it the first batter he had faced in the next
inning?
It
might have been. I
think that was probably it.
I don't know.
I remember I went back and watched that specific inning for the post I was writing today because he struck out Jason Kipnis in his next at-bat. And so, yeah, he throws behind Davis. I think he still gets him out in the at-bat, which I guess is kind of the way to do it. Like, you throw behind the guy, you don't actually hit him, for one, and you still get a chance to get him out.
Hey, works for me. I mean... Play it smart. You still got to win these ball games at some point, especially when it's Cleveland we're talking about. Lastly, before we bail out of this segment, let's talk a little bit about the bullpen. And honestly, I haven't checked the numbers recently, and it's the failing offense has been so much more the big topic. I haven't even hardly noticed, I don't think, what the bullpen.
Yeah, not
been.
Necessarily. I mean, Bruce Rondon's still been putting up some pretty solid numbers. I think Alex Wilson has still been performing well, but like we'd said before, Justin Wilson's an issue. People were getting upset about Mark Lowe coming into a game at one point, and the Tigers were down by like 5 runs. It's like, well, yeah, that's when you use him.
I think it was down 4, and he made it 5. I think that's what pissed people off, because it was like, yeah, ninth
still
inning.
4 runs.
Yeah. I'm on that side of, I'm not sure why he's ever pitching ever at this point, because he literally gives up a run. It's pretty close to 50% of the time. So
yeah, I mean, with expanded rosters at this point, you could hide him. It seems weird to me that the Tigers haven't called up more random bullpen arms. I mean, they have several guys on the 40-man roster that aren't on the major league roster right now. I know that Warwick Saupold had that whole issue with like the bar fight, and so I don't know if he's getting like any sort of disciplinary action. But you have some other, like, I mean, they're all random guys and they're not really going to help. But, you know, if you need a guy for mop-up duty, throw one of them out there and save your best arms for better games.
Yeah, for once, it kind of feels like the bullpen's not really the issue. And for that matter, starting pitching has been pretty darn decent. We touched on that last week, the fact that the Tigers had a top three starting rotation for both July and August. It's dipped a little bit in September, of course, because they let Jordan Zimmermann start and they let Mike Pelfrey start. And Aníbal Sanchez blew up at least once in September. So you do have, again, the veterans are killing the starting rotation. With those guys out of it and the kids running the show, they've had a top three starting rotation. The bullpen is the bullpen. I mean,
yeah.
I will go to my grave saying that 2016, the bullpen was marred because the starting pitching sucked so bad in the first half that they got overused, overexposed.
Yeah, that could definitely be it. Apparently, Jordan Zimmermann threw another like simulated game today or whatever. I didn't really pay attention to the tweets this time around. It wasn't quite as fun to follow as that first time. But apparently, Daniel Norris made like a diving catch, or not a diving, but like a leaping catch towards the wall that people were impressed by, which yes. is, you know, fun. Not great that Jordan Zimmermann's giving up contact all the way to the wall,
right?
Especially at Target Field, but all the same.
I will wager that we'll see Zimmermann make one more start before this whole thing is said and done, but I wouldn't bet on it being a very good one.
See, Daniel Norris is like the guy you could do that whole Joe Maddon thing where you put the pitcher in left field for a little while and switch two guys back and forth. Apparently he's, you know, quite the athlete, so he could definitely hold his own out there.
Counterpoint, he keeps hurting himself. He keeps hurting himself on stupid things like box jumps and, you know, he hit that home run last year and then he hurt his oblique or something. So,
well, when he is healthy, he's probably a better defender than some of the guys we have right now.
This may be true, but Daniel, stick to pitching. Don't hurt yourself leaping for a fly ball. Please, please. We've had enough. All right, I am going to move on unless you had anything else to kind of throw in before we... All right, cool. Take a quick break. Come back with segment two, warming in the pen, and throw the projections out. More on that after the break.
Sanchez looks in and gets the sign from Brian Pena. Pena's setting up away. The 2-2. Swing! Wow. And a miss! He got it on strikes! A new club record! 17 strikeouts by Aníbal Sanchez, and he strikes out the side in the eighth.
And we are back with round two, warming in the pen. I'm saying let's just throw the projections out. Rob, every week we talk about the upcoming matchups. Every week we talk about the percentages, the win expectancy, and how the Tigers should perform in those, you know, various series. Are they going to finish this week 4-2 or 3-3? And it seems like every week we're kind of disappointed. So let's just not make any more predictions. Let's just assume the absolute worst. They're going to get swept by the Twins. They're going to get swept by the Royals. And they're going to be completely out of contention by the end of the week. Sound good?
I mean, they're winning right now.
Don't say that. You'll jinx the whole thing.
I mean,
who's on tonight? It's Matt Boyd and...
Boyd. And they're facing Hector Santiago.
Okay, so they should... you know, beat up on him.
Yeah, well, Santiago's had some pretty good numbers. I was looking at it today, and both Santiago and Ervin Santana, two of the three starters the Tigers are facing this week, actually have really good numbers against Detroit. Like, for his career, I think Santiago's ERA is like 3.0 something. And then Santana's is actually under 3. And so if you're going to face these two guys, that's definitely not the two you want to face when you're going up against the Twins. But
fabulous. Hey,
if Matt Boyd can kind of rebound from whatever the heck it was he did last week, they could be in decent shape.
Did they announce who's pitching tomorrow yet?
Yeah. Did you hear this?
No, it was a question mark.
Buck Farmer is pitching tomorrow. Why in the world is Buck Farmer starting?
Because
tomorrow?
He's not Jordan Zimmermann and he's not Mike Pelfrey. Is the answer to that question.
Yeah, and like when you put it like that, it's actually kind of a good thing that he's probably starting. I think Brad Ausmus himself said like Buck was the best one of the group or something like that. But, you know, it's just kind of frustrating at this point, especially with Fulmer. Like, you might as well just start him because he could start tomorrow a normal rest. It's like this pushing him back again that's like resulting in, you know, him having this weird stretch and then like having to use all these other random pitchers. Yeah, I think that if you just gave him his normal start, he'd only have one more start towards the end of the season if you pitched him a normal rest versus giving him the extra rest at this point. And so it's almost like at this point, you might as well just kind of ride with him.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I guess for me, the frustration, more so than any of that, is the fact that you can't count on a Jordan Zimmermann. The fact that you can't count on a Mike Pelfrey. The fact that you can't count on an Aníbal Sánchez. Any of these guys who, you know, they've been at this game long enough, you should be able to throw any one of them into that position and say, just give me five, five and a half, six decent innings. Two, three runs, you know? And at this point, you absolutely cannot trust those guys to go in there and not completely crap the bed. And yeah, that's just completely unacceptable for this year. It's so frustrating at this point in the year to be at that, you know, stage and saying, yep, you can't trust these guys.
And having all of them, like, do that too. Like, you can't, like, I get it if, like, Sanchez is struggling and Pelfrey is doing something. But, like, if you can't count on one of those three to do that, like, that's just, again, it goes back to just how amazing it is that the, you know, the rookies and the young pitchers are holding so much of the weight here.
There's no way they should be in a playoff race right now, quite frankly, with the way that that's unfolded. There's just no way.
Well, and part of it is that some of these other teams have worse rotations. Like, the Orioles' rotation is a complete dumpster fire. The Astros, I think, are, like, missing, like, their two best starters right now. I think Dallas Keuchel's out for the year and whatnot. And I think that, like, I saw some article today that, like, if the Astros were going to the wild card game, the guy they would probably start is Doug Fister.
Wow.
Yeah, like, that's, I mean, it's just gotten that bad for them. I mean, you have Toronto, who's kind of rotted into shape a little bit, but they're still hitting, you know, kind of the innings limit with Aaron Sanchez. And so the pitching has just kind of been so bad across the board. I mean, for one, Rick Porcello is going to win the Cy Young,
exactly,
which I guess tells you everything you need to know about the pitching in the American League this
year. He's having a fantastic year, though. Good for him. Good for Kid Rick.
He really is. I mean, he's like actually turned himself into a legitimate Cy Young contender, too.
Right.
He's got, what, 21 wins now. He just threw a complete game against the Orioles last night, which also helped out the Tigers. So thanks for that.
A complete game.
Thanks for that,
in less than 90 pitches.
Yeah.
He was, I mean, I looked at his peripherals just because I think, you know, I'd hate to see him win the Cy Young just on the wins alone, but the peripherals are looking pretty damn good.
They are looking pretty good. I mean, he was like top five, I think, in FIP last I checked. You know, he's got 200 innings under his belt, or really close. He's going to hit it.
Strikeout to walk ratio is like six right now. It's like best
in the
league.
Yeah, I mean, it's best in the league, and that's just because he's not walking anyone. I think I saw a tweet today that he's walked like one guy since like August.
Good.
Like
for
the start
him.
Of August, yeah. I think. Yeah, it was like 45, 46 innings, one walk.
And now that we're kind of already off topic and talking about other teams pitching, it does bring to mind, too, the fact that, you know, the fallout of what happened on Saturday with Carlos Carrasco getting knocked out, and he's broken his hand and won't be back this year. The Indians had already lost Danny Salazar, most likely for the rest of the year. That's another team now that they're going to be struggling, I think, to put together a good starting rotation down the rest of the stretch and into the playoffs, which sucks for them. They're finally going to get into the playoffs, and what are they going to do?
And if you look at it, like, if you think about all the teams that could potentially get in the playoffs, like, who has the best starting rotation of the bunch? You would almost be pressed to say the Tigers. Like, I mean, if you think about it, maybe the Mariners are in that conversation too. But with the Red Sox, like, if David Price returns to form, sure, you can count
okay,
him.
Yep.
But, like, other than that, like, the Orioles rotation that we said is awful. The Blue Jays, not really that impressive. And then, you know, the Tigers with the kind of front load rotation that they have, if they got smart and put, you know, Verlander, Fulmer, and then like either Boyd or Norris in that playoff rotation, they could be in good shape.
It's an interesting perspective, but I think you're right. Yeah, with the injuries to Salazar and Carrasco, put together a playoff rotation, the Tigers might actually hold their own in that. I mean, I don't know that their offense would be able to survive any of those other teams. You talk about the Orioles being a dumpster fire, and yet the Tigers couldn't do jack or squat against them last weekend. So who knows anymore? Upcoming, we talked about the Twin Series a little bit. Then comes three games versus the Kansas City Royals. That's going to be just a crapshoot, I think, at this point.
It really is. I mean, the Royals have been so up and down this year. You know, they were struggling on the road and playing really well at home, and then they come out and sweep the Tigers on the road, and the Tigers take two or three on the road. It really is kind of a question mark at this point. The Royals have definitely struggled lately. I think they've definitely fallen back out of playoff contention. I don't know if they were, like, mathematically eliminated yet or not, but they're...
I want to say they are. I think
they're getting close to it at this point, and so, you know, you kind of got to wonder what exactly you're going to see out of this team in the next few games.
I know they've got to be close because a few days back, Max, our friend Max over at Royals Review, was tweeting about the fact that they had gone from a 0% chance of making the playoffs per Fangraphs to a 0.4%. And he was all excited about that, like, 0.4% nudge. Like, okay, woo, we're still in it.
They're not mathematically eliminated yet, but they're five games out of the wild card. And they're, their elimination number. Oh no, that's in the division. But yeah, they're 5 games out of the wild card right now, behind several other teams, including the Yankees, who have stormed back a little bit, as well as Seattle, Houston, and Detroit.
So again, like you said, they've been so up and down. I would have said 2 weeks ago, oh, that should be easy pickings, taking on the Royals. But then they kind of surged a little bit there, and then they've been kind of struggling again. So this series is at Comerica, if I'm correct, right? That's not in Kansas City. Okay, so that helps.
Yeah.
You know, they usually have a pretty good record at home, but if we're not dealing with that, I just know the Tigers need to win as many of these freaking games as they possibly can, because don't you feel like they got to win, what, there's, after tonight, 12 left?
Yep.
So we'll just say 13. They need to win, like, 8 at least.
I think at least 8, and I think that to feel comfortable, you got to get upwards of, like, 9 or 10.
Yeah. And that when you start to do the math and realize there's 3 against the Twins, there's 3 against the Royals, then you got the final 4 against Cleveland. Look out. And then the final 3 of the season against Atlanta. There's not a lot of games left to do this. You're talking about some series sweeps and having to do some damage against the Indians to get to that 9 or 10 win number.
Yeah, and the one thing that we kind of touched on this last week, but almost might help out a little bit, is that the Indians are so close to winning the division that they might clinch it either in the early part of that series against the Tigers or right before that series against the Tigers. And so if the Indians clinch, like, do they start to rest guys? Maybe they back off on Kluber a little bit. Like, maybe he starts and throws 80 pitches or something like that, as opposed to, like, the usual 100, 110, 120. And so, you know, as they're resting guys and getting ready for the postseason, do the Tigers take advantage of that then? Are the Indians a little less, I guess, hungry, if you want to put it that way, and kind of go feelings ball? And do the Tigers take advantage of that a little bit? And so it'll be interesting to see exactly what happens. Again, the Indians are going to have that depleted rotation without Salazar, without Carrasco. And so at least in 2 of those games, you're facing a guy who was at the back end, or if not even in the rotation at all for most of the season for them.
Now, the smart-ass in me just says, okay, great, so maybe they clinch it and they pull Carrasco out to rest him. And of course, they're without Salazar, you know, and Carrasco. Did I say Carrasco? I meant Kluber. Pull Kluber out of the rotation. You know, so they're without the top 3 maybe by the time Detroit, you know, gets there. But, you know, at least they can't pull out their bullpen and beat us. So, oh, right, they just did that. Okay, so there's that. It's all about this offense, man. They gotta turn it back on. And there are so many pieces of this offense that are kind of falling apart right now, including Cameron Maben, who we always kind of said was the, you know, the straw that stirs the drink, putting up some negative numbers in different places. Kinsler's kind of fallen off. We already said we're going to talk about Victor Martinez and what he's not doing. It's just, it's rough. Did not expect the offense to be the weak link in the down the stretch.
I mean, the one positive is that Maben's actually had an RBI on triple tonight, so.
Did he?
Maybe he'll start to pick out, get out of it a little bit. Yeah, if he gets, you know, further and further away from that latest hand injury, hopefully he'll start to pick it up a little bit. We'll see.
Well, if he's doing well tonight, then he's only about 3 games away from his next injury. So let's see how much we can get out of him in the next 3 and then make that push.
Yeah, and it's still, well, I mean, even with all the injuries, it still boggles my mind that people are unsure about picking up his option for next season. It's only like $8 or $9 million. You might as well do it. As much as he gets injured, you have no replacement ready on the, you know, on the major minor league roster for center field. Like, unless you really trust Anthony Ghost to kind of pull it in gear and get going.
You'd have to be looking at guys like Jacoby Jones to do it or something.
Like, you know, $8 or $9 million for a guy like Cameron Maben, even as often as he's injured, I think is still a valuable commodity. I mean, he's been, you know, worth much more than that this season based on like the WARs per, or dollars per WAR alone. And so I think that that's a no-brainer to pick up. And it's still surprising to me that people are like iffy about this.
No, I mean, I get the frustration with saying, look, he's literally missed like half of the games this year. It's been, he's given us half a season, but even half a season at the WAR number that he's put up, you know, what, $8 or $9 million for a half a season is pretty good considering, I think, the alternatives. I'll take that half the season. They were only going to, realistically, the original plan was they were going to split him with Ghost anyway. He wasn't going to play 160 games.
Yeah.
You know, so let's not talk about Anthony Ghost anymore, though, because that situation bums me out. The 2017 schedule is out. Not to really play into our listeners' hands who are like, yeah, quit talking about this year. It's over. Let's talk about next year already. And, you know, so,
I couldn't even remember if we had talked about this last week or not.
It didn't come out, I don't think, when we recorded last Tuesday. So,
no. Yeah, I couldn't remember when it came out. But, you know, I always kind of find it a little bit interesting to kind of look ahead and see, you know, where some of the tougher stretches might be, where the Tigers are going to catch a little bit of a break. They play the NL West next season, but surprisingly still only have two trips out west, unless you count like the little like mini three-game series against the Rockies.
Now, this is what I love, though, because these NL West trips that we're taking have not been done, at least not for me, for a very long time that I can remember. They're going to play the Padres, mm-hmm. which I don't remember the last time they did that. They're going to play.
They did that a few years ago.
It's been maybe 2011.
No, I thought 2012. It was 2014.
No, not the Padres.
Yeah. No, they did it in, I think it was 2014, because it was just like right at the beginning of the season. They went out west, they played a couple games against the Dodgers.
No, you're right, they did. Because they
did it against the Padres.
Cashner, and that's where Justin Verlander got his first hit. So, Man, I have got to stop hitting my head on, things. I don't remember a lot of stuff. So forget that I just said that. The Rockies, however, I don't remember the last time they played the Rockies.
I mean, it probably would have been the same season, but I don't remember those games at all.
Hmm. I kind of like the idea, though, right? I mean, you got this big thumping Tigers lineup, send them out to Coors Field, and just see what happens.
Yeah, no, I wish like there would be like a little bit of collusion here and have the Tigers pitch like either Sanchez or Matt Boyd against like their most homer prone pitcher and just see how many home runs they can hit.
I'm all for a slugfest.
Like, that would be wild. Just Dingerfest 2017. Let's see what happens.
And if they do that, then you have to load up a fantasy lineup, get on, whoever, FanDuel or DraftKings, and just load up on Rockies and Tigers.
All your money on that game.
Nice. So beyond that, the usual, they've got the 2-2 with the Pittsburgh Pirates, I think.
Yep.
As they normally do. What did you notice in terms of kind of lumping games together in any given stretch of months where it's easy, it's hard, it's whatever?
I mean, May is gonna suck. Like, did you see the numbers on that one?
Yes, May is, I can't remember now. There's a slew of teams that are, like, really good there.
Let's just kind of start at the top here. They play 29 games in May,
No rest.
29 games in 31 days. They start with a home series against the Indians, and I think they go out west, and then there's, like, another home series. I think the home series are against, like, Kansas City and Houston or something like that, and then they have another road trip. I think the final number was 19 of their 29 games are on the road.
Yeah, and it seems to me, I'm looking at the schedule, but from memory, I think some of those teams were decent teams. Like, the Indians aren't going to be a pushover. They're playing, like, Texas, I think, in there.
Yeah.
Some decent teams. It's not going to be... Yeah. It seems that I saw... I thought, like, the next hardest after that would have been, like, July, but it's not nearly as hard as May.
Yeah, not so bad.
As long as the tough months aren't happening, like, in September.
Then, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, no, I mean, the last couple of years, the Tigers have gotten hit with kind of the tough stretches early on. I know that this year we commented that April was fairly rough, and the start of May wasn't too great either. And so if the Tigers can kind of get through those first couple of months in relatively good shape, they should be able to coast a little bit down the stretch. Of course, we said that, and, the Tigers are below 500 in September this year.
Yeah, I think they were below 500 for most of the first half. So it's just been that kind of year, up, down, they've really kind of losing ground. As long as I win the bet that I made with Vegas that they would win more than 81 games, then I'm happy. If they can't do that, good
God. I mean, you're on pace for that. What, they have a 79, 80 in it right now?
They're at 79, I think, right now. So
You should get that.
They should be able to. Care to make a prediction before we cut out of this segment? Over the next 13, and I know they're winning right now, but still we'll say the next 13. What are you banking on?
I think they win eight. I think we get... I mean, you're going to hate me for saying this, but I think we get a game 163.
Oh, like a sudden death play-in against whoever, Baltimore or
against,
Toronto.
Yeah, Baltimore
or whoever's...
or Toronto or something like that.
Yeah, you're right. I hate you because that's not – I don't know if I can do two of those in a row.
Yeah, that would be kind of weird, like, especially if they have to win in like game 162 to get there. They'd basically like be three sudden death games right in a row.
Yeah. Yeah, that which would be kind of like going through an ALDS and then – I'm going to say you're probably right about that. I just don't see them rattling off enough wins here to like absolutely lock it down. I've heard numbers like, they have to go 10-3 and that would really clinch it. Well, they're not going to go 10-3. They could, but they're probably not. And that's, I'm not trying to be pessimistic. I'm just trying to be realistic. This team has had some real rough patches here. I know they've rattled off 8 and 9 game winning streaks before, but that's back when the offense was clicking.
Yeah, and we even look at this last series of the season in Atlanta. Like, Atlanta's been tearing the cover off the ball. I saw a tweet from, I think it was Jeff Sullivan today,
yes,
that said,
yes,
that the Braves were the worst offense in the National League before the All-Star break, and yes, since the All-Star break, they've been the best offense in the National League.
Unreal.
So those games aren't necessarily pushovers at this point.
No. I thought about, when I saw that same tweet, I think he was quoting the WRC Plus stat and saying it was the lowest in the National League before the break, after it's like the highest. And I thought of you immediately because I was like, damn it, Rojacki was right. They were going to get, you know, because you said before, towards the end of the season, they were going to be bringing up some of the young talent, you know.
Yep.
Playing.
I mean,
this,
they still have over 90 losses at this point, so it hasn't really helped them, but still, it might not be so easy to win those games.
And I think Atlanta's got a shot at being halfway decent next year, too, quite honestly. They've been looking at some of their players, some of their numbers, and it's like, geez, if they knew how to score any runs at all, they could be a force. So we'll just see if the Tigers have to face, what's his name, Tehran.
Yeah, we'll see. I couldn't even tell you who the other pitchers are on the staff at this point.
No, I don't think I could either.
No idea.
He's been performing quite well. Well, we'll see. I'm gonna go ahead and predict 8, even though I said I'm not gonna do any more projections or predictions. I'm gonna say 8 wins over the next 13.
I mean, that would get them above my projected total of 85 for the year. So.
Yeah, I think they'll scrape it. They'll wall scrape that when it gets to maybe like 86, 87, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. Okie dokie. All right, quick break time. We'll come back with the high and tight segments. And hey, MLB, maybe don't change the rules. More on that right after the break.
3-2 pitch. Swinging a line drive left center field. Jackson on the run. He'll make the catch in left center. Max Scherzer, a pump of the fist as he comes off the mound. The bases are loaded with nobody out. He strikes out 2 and hits Kiasko on the line.
And welcome back as we continue with the discussion. Time for our high and tight segment. There has been some talk, well, God, Rob, there's been talk for months and months about the fact that the collective bargaining agreement is expiring at the end of this year as part of the renewal process. There's a good chance that there could be some changes introduced into the official MLB rules. And there was a piece that was out on ESPN today by Jim Bowden, talking about what some of these rules changes might be. I know you got a chance to read it. I got a chance to read it. Let's just kind of talk a little bit about how absolutely moronic half of these rules changes.
Yeah,
really,
I mean,
are.
I really hope that like most of these never see the light of day.
Most of them. Okay, let me just start with the September roster expansion. They talked about the fact that, okay, hey, no more going to the 40-man roster. Let's just go ahead and say that all year long, not just September, but all year long, you can go up to 30 on the roster. I think that's a good idea.
To get up to 30? I mean, God, games would be so long with all the pitching changes and whatever.
Well, maybe, but there just seems like throughout any year, there's so much of the, you know, up and down and up and down. We had to send so-and-so to Toledo and back up and this and that. Just make it 30, you know, if you need 5 extra, so what? And then you don't do the extra 40,
I mean,
to 40 in September.
Yeah, and you wonder, like, how in favor of this the owners would be, because the players' union is obviously going to be happy with it. You know, more guys are getting paid more money, but will the owners agree to that? I'm not sure. The one thing that I would like to see is that, and I know this is kind of a popular one, but, like, you take your 40-man roster in September and you name 25 guys before the game. Like, those are your 25. And, yeah, you can, like, you know, finagle it a little bit, and so that you can have 4 extra relievers, because you're not going to name like your next day starter as like the guy on like the, like, if, you know, Daniel Norris is starting on Wednesday, he's not going to be on the Tigers active roster on Tuesday type of thing. So you can finagle that a little bit, but I still think that that would help cut down on some of these, you know, excessive pitching changes. Looking at you, Robin Ventura,
who I was just looking at a box score from a couple of days ago. I don't know why I was even looking at it, but I looked at one inning and it was, he changed pitchers for literally every single out that was recorded. I was like, holy crap, dude, that is messed up. But let's talk about that, because that's another one of the proposed changes. Pitching change limits, and I'm quoting from the article now. It says, it looks like there's enough support among clubs to implement a new rule requiring pitchers to finish an inning or face a minimum of 3 batters unless injured. That's a big fat no from me.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that one either. You know, a lot of people aren't necessarily fans of the bullpen specialization that has happened over the last several years, or last,
you know, decade plus or however you want to kind of divide it up. But I think that kind of taking the game out of the manager's hands would be a little bit frustrating. I mean, yeah, there's still a certain amount of strategy that goes into that, you know, when you bring a guy in or whatnot. But I think that teams should be able to change pitchers whenever they want.
Yeah, because I'm not, like, you know, a huge fan of the whole specialization, the, you know, loogies and that kind of thing. I mean, I think managers overplay it. I think a lot of times pitchers can be better against their sort of platoon split than you might otherwise think. I was saying earlier, Bruce Rondon actually has really, really good numbers against left-handers this year for some reason. And Justin Wilson's a guy who, for his career, has always had better numbers against righties, et cetera, et cetera. But it does still happen. It absolutely still happens that you run into a situation where, like, no, I don't want a lefty facing this guy who destroys lefties, so I should be able to go, you know, make the change and then change that guy back out before, you know.
Yeah, and one thing that that Bowden had touched on is that, like, guys might start, like, faking injuries and whatnot, and I'm, you know, not a huge fan of that one. Like, especially because he said, like, that you could, like, set a minimum number of games they have to sit out if they do get an injury. Well, like, what if he, like, tweaks his hamstring but he's fine the next day? Like, yeah. What if there's an actual injury and he's still fine? Like, I'm not a big fan of that one.
I'll come back to the other reasons in a second here, but there's more to that. Another rule talking about adding a pitch clock, which that was suggested last year, I know, and the rule about hitters having to stay in the batter's box. Now, I thought they already implemented at least that part of it. I thought hitters were supposed to go out of the box.
I thought they were supposed to as well, and I was like, they were going to get fined if they weren't. I would rather just keep it that way, like hit the players in the wallets and they'll eventually learn. It seems like the pace of game has picked up a little bit, you know, even if the numbers aren't necessarily reflecting that and like the total amount of time that games are taking. I think there was like a noticeable difference from, what was it, 2014 to 2015 when they implemented this. I thought the games like felt faster.
I'll say this about pitch clocks, and this goes back to Saturday's game, which, you know, I was sitting there in the stands watching Verlander spin his masterpiece, but I will tell you, this is maybe a different topic for a different time, but he could not get on the same page with Saltalamacchia that entire game. I counted
It was the first time in several starts. I mean, we're talking months here that Saltalamacchia had caught him. Yeah. Like, McCann was his catcher for most of the year, and I don't know why Salty was catching that game, but... You know, it was definitely odd to see Saltalamacchia catching him that game.
It was noticeable. I counted probably 10 to 12 times throughout the game where Verlander would be looking in for the pitch and just looking and looking and looking. And at least 10 to 12 times, he finally had to step off. And it was just over and over and over. And the crowd started booing. The number of times he had to step off the mound, let's do the signal reset and then back into it. I'm like, oh my God, he has no clue. These two are not communicating. But... back to this rule change about a pitch clock. In a situation like that, I don't want my pitcher being forced to have to, you know, decide on pitches when he's not in sync with his catcher. I think that's just...
No, definitely not. And you wonder, like, if this pitch clock would be, you know, if pitchers could work around that just by, like, stepping off the rubber or something, or if we'd see more mound visits from catchers or whatnot. Like, I think that just encouraging them to you know, play the game a little bit faster and find them when they don't is a better solution than actually putting some sort of like ball or strike penalty on, you know, delaying things by stepping out of the box or stepping off the rubber.
And along those same lines, another rule suggestion was no trips to the mound by the coaches or managers unless there's an actual pitching change. Again, I think you're getting into a realm where you're interfering with strategy.
Yeah, I mean, you're interfering with strategy. Like, a lot of times pitching coaches will go out to settle a guy down, and, you know, whether or not they're saying anything important, I think it does have a little bit of an impact with some guys, especially like with younger pitchers. You know, you get them relaxing a little bit more out there. Like, coaches go out to talk strategy. And so, like, even with it, like, the infield comes in. I'm actually watching it right now with the Red Sox. There's a, you know, I think there's a pitching coach out there right now, and the whole infield is in. They're talking about a strategy on how to pitch to a guy. And I think that you lose that if you don't let coaches go to the mound.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to what we were hinting at earlier, which is just, you know what, if this is all about shaving off seconds, precious seconds, stop. Just stop. Are we really that pressed for time? I mean, come on. It seems just a little bit overkill and silly to me. Here's another one. Intentional walks not being thrown. I know we talked about that last year. Basically, if there's an intentional walk, the catcher signals four fingers and the batter just takes the base, no pitch is thrown. Well, we've seen plenty of times where pitchers have tried to make the intentional walk and thrown wild pitches in the process.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think the Tigers won a walk-off in that. They did. It was against Cleveland.
Yeah.
In the ninth inning, Kinsler scored from third on a wild pitch. I mean, I guess I'm not as stuck on that one if they want to make it a flash four and go.
Yeah, no, like I wouldn't be like too upset if that happened, because like these instances happen, once a year or something like that. Like, mm-hmm. Who was the last guy to like actually hit an intentional walk pitch? Probably Miguel Cabrera back in 2002 or whatever it was. And so this one doesn't bother me as much. I just don't think there's much of an impact. Like, this happens, what? You get an intentional walk, what, one every three or four games, and you're shaving off 30 seconds.
I liked this one. He talked about possibly standardizing the DH rule. But what came out of the article was that two things. Number one, that there does seem to be a lot of like agreement that it should be standardized. But of course, they can't agree on what it should be standardized to either use it or not use it. So now you're right back to where the problem started.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think we're getting to a point where there's going to be a DH in the National League. It seems like the baseball's heading that way. A lot of pitchers, like, especially I think it was like, what, Adam Wainwright, who was very vocal about it when he had gotten injured or something along those lines. And so I think that, with the number of jobs it creates, like the way it extends careers for some hitters, I think the players union will be all for that when the time comes to get there.
I remember he pointed that out in the article too, and said, like, you got guys like Albert Pujols who still have a lot of years left on a contract. There's no way he's going to agree to, not having a DH rule.
Well, and I think it almost creates a bit of a competitive imbalance for the American League teams, because they can afford to overpay a guy like Pujols, because they know they're like, okay, in 4 or 5 years, we can just stick him at DH and he doesn't have to play the field anymore. Whereas National League teams can't do that.
Get rid of it. Just get rid of the imbalance, make everyone use the DH, and let's have done with it. Okay, the stupidest thing on this list was his own suggestion, moving to the 7-inning baseball game. Do you want 5 minutes to just swear and rant on that?
No, I mean, I need 5 seconds. It's never going to happen.
I don't know why you would want it to. I mean, that is such a drastic change to the game at this point. Really, you're going to cut off the last 2 innings? Get out of here with that. That's just...
Yeah, no. No, the one I was interested by is him talking about expansion. I don't necessarily think it's going to happen like immediately, but to get to a point where maybe baseball adds 2 more teams, you can go back to a more balanced schedule because there'll be 16 teams in every league. I think it'd be interesting. I think that it thins the talent pool a little bit. I mean, we're already at a point where like there's such a big gulf between big money teams and small money teams. Like, even though we had the whole Moneyball revolution and everything, I think the tables have been turned a little bit, and now the big money teams are using these same advantages and, kind of creating that competitive imbalance again. And so I think that there should be more of that, a bigger gulf in talent if you add 2 more teams.
Yeah, he talked about doing that out west, I think, wasn't it? Like maybe a Las Vegas team, now that we're talking about adding a NHL team out there or a football team, possibly one in like New Mexico, something to that effect.
God, could you imagine all the home runs that would happen in those? Like, you already have the Pacific Coast League out in like New Mexico and Las Vegas and whatnot. That would just be insane. The one I would like is to see Montreal get a team.
They had a team. It's why can't they have it again? That was not nice to take that away from them. Montreal was a fun team.
Exactly.
I missed the Expos.
From what I've heard, it's a very fun city to go to as well. That'd be a lot of fun to spend some time there. I do like how the Nationals completely ignore any, semblance of the Expos franchise. Like, they always talk about, like, all these franchise records, and it's like, well, yeah, if you don't count whatever the Expos did 2 years before.
Well, because the Expos had Tim Raines, who was just, like, setting franchise records.
The Expos had a lot of dudes.
What's that?
The Expos had a lot of dudes, a lot of great players.
I think they had Andre Dawson at one point, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, it's been a long time since the Expos existed and since I was, 10 years old and collecting the baseball cards. But, yeah, they did have, seems like, quite a few.
Yeah, and you want to know who built those teams?
Go ahead.
Dave Dombrowski.
What?
Yeah, he was a GM, the Expos.
When?
For 4 years, from 88 to 91.
No kidding.
I'm looking at it now. Yeah, he was like the one that kind of brought in a lot of those guys that, especially the 94 team, the Expos team that was really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was responsible for bringing some of those guys in. The Expos, like, if you go back and look, the Expos had such a ridiculous amount of talent in their front office, like so many like GMs and whatnot, like big names. I'm blanking on guys right now, but there were so many big names in those front offices for that Expos team, and it was amazing that they never really won anything.
Yeah, because they came really close in the strike year that shortened the season, and they ended up not having a World Series that year. People always said like the Expos were on pace to probably own everybody that year, and it didn't. They didn't finish the season, so. Bring baseball back to Montreal. I am all for that. especially if they call it the Montreal Expos, because that was such a great, stupid name.
I feel like Montreal would riot if they didn't have the if it wasn't the Expos.
I feel like you're right. That's cool. All right. I think that was it for that segment. I'm looking over the notes. Yes, looks like we touched on all the points. So we'll take a quick break, come back with our End of the Mob Scene at Home segment, take some listener questions, and we're talking about 50 ways to fire your manager right after the break.
Swinging a fly ball to left field. This one's deep. Going back, Gentry at the fence. It's gone! Wow. It's gone! A walk-off grand slam in the bottom of the ninth for Rosie Davis. Incredible! Around third, into the mob, skid it home.
And we are back, ready to head into the mob scene at home. It's that part of the show where we take questions from our listeners. You know how to get a hold of us. We are on Twitter. I'm at Hookslide23. Rob is at BYBRob. We have quite a few questions to get through, so let's get right to it. 50 ways to fire your manager. There seems to be a running theme in the questions this week, but we'll start with at C_Strand99 wants to know, if the Tigers make the postseason by the skin of their teeth, does Brad stay?
Yeah, I think he would. I really have no idea where the Tigers are going to go at this point, but I think that I think that he will get that like last year of his contract, unless they like just utterly collapse down the stretch. Like if they're winning a game or two, I think that Osmus might be back. If they make the playoffs, he'll probably be back. It's more like, you know, what happens if they go like 5-7, 5-8 or whatever. I can't do math right now. If they do that down the stretch.
If they collapse, basically, then yeah. And I'm unfortunately, as much as I would love to argue the point, I think he's coming back, honestly, no matter what. I would think they would have to like go 0-13 down the stretch for the Tigers to finally, you know, let him go. I think he's coming back. I hate to say that, but just my opinion. At @I_of_the_Tigers says, do you think Fulmer can still win Rookie of the Year, or are they going to give it to Gary Sanchez?
I honestly kind of think it depends on what happens in Fulmer's last couple starts. As far as Sanchez goes, he's really kind of cooled off in September. So I think that, you know, any sort of pressure that he was putting on Fulmer might be kind of falling by the wayside. But you have Nomar Mazara out in Texas, who's having a great year. The Rangers have the best record in the American League. And so that always plays a role in voters' minds as well. I think that Fulmer still probably ekes it out, but I think that if anyone's going to finish second at this point, it's going to be Mazara and not Sanchez.
Yeah, and I'm still voting Fulmer all the way, so bank that one.
Oh, for sure. I think that he should win it. I think he should be a shoo-in for it, honestly. But
yeah, it should
I think
not
that,
be close.
You know, with the way that voters think, I think it's going to be a little bit closer than we would like.
If he'd only gotten to 20 wins, it would be a lock. But he might have got to Cy Young at that point. I don't know. Okay. At Tena JD wants to know, why is Cleveland the Tigers' nemesis all year?
I think it really has to do with the pitching staff that they have. You know, they have so many great right-handed pitchers. The Tigers' lineup is a little bit right-handed heavy. Even though they've put up better numbers against righties than lefties for most of the year, I think that, you know, the righty-on-righty matchup there is definitely wreaking havoc with them a little bit. You also have, you know, I've read a lot of things about the Indians pitching that the Tigers inside a lot more, and I think that has really helped. Obviously, they have the power arms to do that. You can't necessarily do that with a lot of other starting rotations, and so they have that advantage kind of built in. But, you know, their insistence on pitching the Tigers inside, kind of getting them to move their feet and making them a little bit more uncomfortable at the plate, I think is also having a reason having a big reason why. And then, you know, the voodoo curse over the Tigers pitching staff as far as in Cleveland's lineup goes, that obviously plays a role as well.
It is very strange the way that's played itself out. And I'll say that, you know, another big reason why Cleveland's been such a pain in the butt all year, if you look back at the games that they played, Aníbal Sanchez was imploding left and right, and he made 4 starts. I think he's the Tiger that has the most starts against that club, not counting now with the weekend series. Now that Verlander's pitched again, I think he might have gone 4 himself, but it was Sanchez, and he got lit up, you know, almost every time. You had the odd situation where Verlander gave up, what, 4 or 5 home runs in one inning?
Yeah.
He hasn't done that all year. Mm-hmm. There were some games in there, like the one where he, you know, he lost the game because of one stupid home run from Marlon Byrd. Yep. That, you know, that could have gone either way. But still, overall, there is a freaking voodoo curse, I'm telling you.
Mm-hmm.
We watched.
Yeah, and I mean, this doesn't usually happen. Yeah, the Tigers have played horribly against Cleveland this year. But no team is, what is their record now, 14-2?
Yeah,
2-14 bad, 2-13. no team is 2-13 bad against another team.
No, and that rarely happens. I mean, there's always like that one nemesis, and oddly enough for the Indians, it's the Twins. They're like 10-9 against the Twins. So for some reason, the Twins can beat up on the Indians, but the Tigers can't. And I like your idea as much as any other idea that, you know, I know they're pitching them inside, and the Tigers, you know, power hitters need to get their arms extended. So it's just weird. They've beat up on our pitching. Our offense has been able to do jack squat. Did you see the run differential before
I don't know if
Saturday's,
I want to.
Before Saturday's game, it was 90-40. The Indians had outscored us 90-40.
How much of that makes up the Indians' total run differential for the season?
You know how much of their record is made up of Tigers' wins?
True.
And I keep pointing this out on Twitter, on the radio, to anybody who will listen, if you take the head-to-head matchups out, the Tigers have a better record. They've won more games, they've lost fewer games than the Indians. But friggin' 13-2 will put you on the wrong side of, you know, that's why they're in second place. Okay. One more question there from Tenergy. For me specifically, Hookslide, why are you putting your money on Pelfrey and Lowe for next year? Just to clarify, I think this is from a Twitter conversation. I'm not putting my money on Pelfrey or Lowe. I'm just saying I don't think they're going to be as horridly atrocious as they were this year.
I mean, it would be hard for Mark Lowe, especially, to be worse than he was this year.
Lowe is one I could see maybe being as bad or just slightly worse, because I don't think he's ever been that great. But Pelfrey,
no, but he's never been this bad either.
No, that's true. I guess the same thing is true of Pelfrey. I mean, he's having a career worst year in some respects. He's definitely, you know, pitching worse than his career averages all season. So it's just hard for me to imagine that happening again. Of course, I said the same damn thing last year about Aníbal Sánchez and said he'll never repeat that in 2016. And guess what? So
I still don't know if Mike Pelfrey is going to get the chance to repeat that next year. I think he's going to be in the bullpen to start the year.
You might be right. And that might be a great spot for him. I hope that if that happens, that he just absolutely lights it up out there and becomes, you know, the next dependable seventh, eighth, you know, whatever type guy. Because you got to get something out of that $8 million contract next year. All right. At AureliaFan4 says, what should be done about V-Mart in 2017-2018? And I know we're going to talk about that towards the end of the show. But the question here is likelihood that he will retire, and who is his likely replacement?
Yeah, this is kind of something that I was kind of independently brought up with some other people a little bit earlier today, is that, like, you know, what happens if V-Mart retires? Like, the question that I asked was, would the Tigers be better off if Martinez retired after this year?
And I'm sure there's some numbers that would tell you one way or the other, but, you know,
overall, he still had a good year.
He was great the first half. You know, there were times when we thought, like, hey, he's kind of having a resurgence and he's not going to touch 2014, but he's, you know, he's back to being a contributor to this team. So I don't know. I know, like I said, I know we're going to cover that kind of in detail in the last segment of the show.
Yeah, but for the year, he's hitting .287 with a .346 on base percentage and a .466 slugging. He has 24 home runs.
So there it is. I mean, the only reason we're asking the question, why anybody is asking the question at this point, is because he's had such a prolonged bad streak now down the stretch, precisely when they need, you know, production and runs, because we're trying to win a damn, you know, wild card spot at least. And that's, I think, the only reason why it even comes up. But do you think he's going to retire?
I don't think so. Not this year.
You think he'll ride out the full contract?
Maybe. I mean, I can maybe, like, especially if his knee really gives him trouble next year, like, maybe I could see it, but I don't think it will this year.
All right. We'll come back to that at the final segment and go a little more in depth. At Sports 5176 says, are the Tigers very close to being very good or very bad in 2017, and why?
I don't know. I think if anything, there might be a little bit of an uptick in that they'll actually be pretty good in 2017. I mean, like we've talked about before, we have this good young rotation. The stars on the team aren't getting to the point where they're going to really kind of deteriorate yet. You might see a little bit of a drop off from Victor Martinez, Miguel Cabrera, maybe Justin Verlander a little bit. But you have these young guys coming through. Some of the other younger guys are going to be a year older. You still have JD Martinez, who will be on a contract year. You know, that maybe plays a role for him, and he's having an incredible year. Like, have you looked at JD Martinez's numbers? They're insane.
And they're stunting
really well. Yeah.
And that's the crazy thing. Somebody was just asking. Oh, my son was asking. He's like, wow, he only, you know, he hit 40 home runs last year. I said, well, don't remember. He was, you know, he was out for like 2 months, and he, I think, would have been on pace to touch those numbers again had he not been injured for 2 months.
Yeah, this actually would be a career high for him in batting average. It'd be higher than 2014 on base percentage, higher than 2014 and 2015. Wow. Slugging percentage, just barely eking out 2014. I mean, he's only got 21 home runs, but that's because he's only played in 108 games.
It's unreal. It's unreal. The guy comes out of nowhere, and he's done this, what now, 3 years running. I'm obviously going to say I think the Tigers are very close to being very good, not very bad. But you know that sort of thing can swing and turn on, you know, two or three players having off. We just saw it this year. Zimmerman has a crap year. Pelfrey has a crap year. Upton has a career worst. You know, it doesn't take much more than that to suddenly find yourself struggling. And even on top of that, they've stayed in the hunt. So give me a string of players next year. Give me a good Jordan Zimmerman to kind of go with Verlander, Fulmer, and you've got a knockout 1-2-3.
Yeah, if they get a little bit more luck with, you know, some of the injuries and whatnot, or just the down performance, that they could be a pretty good team.
Give me a healthy Nick Castellanos all year. The dude was set to have a breakout season this year, and now he's, you know, gone.
I mean, he did have a breakout season until he got hurt.
Right. I mean, he was going to actually, you know, I think sustain that, and you know, he wasn't going to necessarily win any awards, but still, it was going to be an amazing, full, productive season. It's just it didn't go our way. Follow-up question here is, who will be the GM and the manager in 2017?
Well, we already talked about Brad Ausmus probably coming back in 2017. I don't think there's any way they fire Al LaVila.
No, and they shouldn't. I don't know. People are like all over this right now. Like,
yeah, I mean, like, and especially, like, who do you go get? There's not really, like, a slam-dunk candidate.
Well, why would that. You want to?
Yeah, I mean, firing a GM, I don't know. Like, especially at this point.
In the not even a full, you know, I guess it's just a little over a full year that he's been with the club. What has he done that's so offensive that he has to get fired at this point? Other than, you know, signing some guys who, how in the hell would you know that these guys were going to have blow up career worst years?
I mean, Mike Avila, you can kind of see coming. You know, Mike Pelfrey maybe to a little bit.
Okay, but we talked about that. We talked about the fact the only reason he freaking signed Avila is because he didn't know he had Justin Upton money.
Yeah.
He would never have signed Avilas.
I think the Mike Pelfrey is kind of the same way. I think that, you know, had he known he could have gone over and above the luxury tax, he would have. He would definitely have pitched things differently. And so it'll be interesting to see how he approaches things this offseason. I still think it's going to be a fairly quiet one, but I don't think we've seen enough from Avila one way or the other to really kind of decide what kind of GM he is yet.
Nope, and his MO is completely different. His MO is to build up the farm system. He wants to start growing the talent from within, and that is going to take some time. That's going to take time to kind of filter through from the draft process all the way up through player development. We've talked on the show about how they're starting to collect more advanced statistics on, or metrics on field, you know, the TrackMan stuff, the StatCast. They're doing that at the minor league levels now. It's going to take time for the results to filter, you know, filter its way up. I'm convinced that you give the guy 2-3 years and we're going to have a team that we look at and go, hey, we're finally doing what, you know, like the Cubs did, what the Cardinals did. We're growing good teams again.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to take longer than that just because the Tigers are starting from such a low standpoint and they're not selling off pieces like the Cubs did, like the Astros did. Like, those teams rebuilt so quickly because they sold everything that wasn't bolted down and got prospects for those guys. Especially if you look at some of the guys, like even in the Phillies rotation right now, they have, what's his name, Vince Velasquez, who they got in a trade. You know, that Aaron Nola was a high draft pick, but some of those other guys in that young rotation, the Braves are doing the same thing right now. They have a ton of young pitchers, you know, none of them we could name earlier, but a ton of young pitchers in that farm system that they're bringing up. And a lot of those guys they got in from trades from, you know, things that weren't bolted down. I think that part of it is what we saw, you know, at the trade deadline with things being kind of so dead this year and no real blockbuster moves, is that a lot of these teams had already sold off their pieces. You know, you didn't have a seller selling off a lot of their, like, you know, rentals and whatnot, because those teams had already traded away rentals during the offseason.
It just kind of boggles my mind how many fans right now are so upset about Al Avila and want to see him gone at the same time. And I'm like, come on.
Yeah, and
the
like,
guy was working with such constraints this year.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, Zimmerman and Upton having down years. Like, no one would have predicted that Justin Upton would have done that. A lot of people praised that signing when it happened because they didn't go after Cespedes after a career year. You had Upton who was younger, who had, you know, been a little bit more consistent as far as his overall numbers had been throughout his career. You had a guy who walked more, whose game was probably going to age a little bit better, and he just had a crap year.
And I get that, you know, there's still, he's trying to build depth, and that takes time. So people will say things like, well, the fact that you have Casey McGee being, you know, your pinch hitter, you know, proves that this is on Avila. He should be fired for that alone. And it's kind of like, look, the guy is working according to a plan right now. It's going to take a couple of years to uproot some of these, you know, lengthy, expensive contracts. Will you give the guy a little more breathing room to kind of build that depth and pick the pieces he wants? Then we can start kind of evaluating who's Al Avila and is it working?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's just one of my bugaboos, I guess. At Kerba 1123 wants to know, do current offensive woes indicate a slump or regression?
I think it's more a slump than anything. Like we've talked about, Miguel Cabrera has been amazing as usual. I was looking at his second half numbers. They're pretty ridiculous. Justin Upton obviously having a great September, really kind of a great month or so since the middle of August. GD Martinez has been amazing. And so I think this, you know, kind of recent stretch, you just had guys who have underperformed a little bit. Ian Kinsler slumped a little bit. You know, Cameron Maven's been dealing with that thumb thing. Victor Martinez is otherwise having a good year and just slumping a bit. And so it's just I think it's just an ill-timed slump for them.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I would call it regression, because it's not like they were, you know, world beaters in the first half. They did their fair share of run scoring, but it's not like it was like, oh my God, they're scoring 8 runs a game. They're going to regress at some point. It was, they did that in the first half with things like Upton not hitting and Miguel Cabrera taking a long time to heat up. You know, it's just that some players that were doing really, really well kind of faded in the second half and they kind of flip-flopped. And, you know, so yeah, I would say this is just, I think a lot of the individual performances, the slumps can almost be expected. You talked about Maven and the hand injury. You talk about, you know, V-Mart and the fact that his leg is half busted at the moment. You know, it makes sense why these guys aren't hitting.
Didn't he get hit in the leg like 2 days in a row?
If it wasn't, it was the same series, I think, at least like maybe a day apart.
Mm-hmm.
No, he didn't get hit in the Saturday game when I was there, so it had to have been like Friday and then Sunday.
Well, he definitely got hit on Sunday. We knew that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was shortly prior to that he got hit on the same damn knee, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, dude, how do you... That's bad luck right there. Of course, that would be the voodoo curse, like we've been saying. At TX Sparty also wants to know, who is managing next year? So maybe the emphasis here would be, if Brad Ausmus is not, which we both said we think he is, but if he's not, who would you even want to see, or who would they get?
I mean, I think they would get Ron Gardenhire. That was kind of the guy that they had talked about before. You know, it's tough to say who that would be, because I think that was more like the Dombrowski type thing. That was kind of when we had heard those rumors when he was still in charge. As far as who Avila would get, it's tough to say. You know, the guy that I had talked about previously that I wouldn't mind seeing is Bud Black. We'll see what happens. I know there was like some rumor at one point that he was going to take the Braves job, but that didn't happen. He's not doing anything right now, so they could have brought him in the middle of the season, but who knows?
Yeah, I haven't a dang clue. And I wouldn't think that they would get Gardenhire, because I think Al Avila is kind of anti that idea. He's trying to bring in a sabermetric revolution. I think he wants a manager who's going to be friendly to that, and I think that's part of the reason why he kept Brad Ausmus, because I think he feels like Brad is teachable. And so outside of that, you know what? It's going to be, I think it would be someone that you haven't heard of. You know, it'll be some bench coach who happens to be, you know, have done some work with MLB Network as an analyst or something like that. Someone who's kind of familiar with sabermetrics and friendly to that kind of thing, if that's the way it's going to go. But you know what? It's going to be Brad. It's going to be Brad Ausmus again, because the baseball gods hate me. At Brett Yode wants to know, what end result to the season will get Brad fired? And what does the result have to be to get his option picked up?
I mean, like we said before, I think that it has to be, you know, pretty bad. Like 4 wins, 5 wins down the stretch. The Tigers are now up 6-0 in the game against the Twins on Tuesday, so it seems like they will win that one. And so you're basically looking at like 3 or 4 wins out of the next 12 to really kind of get into the fire Brad territory.
Do you think it'll be results-based like that, though, or would it have to be something just utterly boneheaded that he specifically did?
I think it's more results-based. Like, I don't really think there's going to be anything at this point that would be so malicious that he would get fired for it, unless it was, like, something ridiculous, like he, like, you know, took a baseball bat to a player during a game or something like that. Obviously. Like, something that would obviously get him fired.
Obviously. But
I don't think there's anything, like, in these last 12 games, I don't think there's any sort of, like, game management thing that's going to be so egregious that, like, that would be the reason he gets fired.
Well, we talked about the way last year when he was trying to work with Daniel Norris and kind of get him stretched out, but also watch the limit, you know, and left him in maybe a little bit too long sometimes. What if he did something like that? You know, puts Daniel Norris out there or Michael Fulmer and he lets him go, like, a full 9 innings or some stupid thing. And
I mean, it didn't get him fired last year, so.
So, there you go. He's never going to get fired. It's just never going to happen. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's results-based. I'm not even sure if only picking up like 3 or 4 wins would even be enough. I think they would have to like literally not win again after today in order for that to happen. Final question. At Tigers underscore opinions wants to know, what would your postseason bullpen look like? Who's in it and what roles? That, of course, assumes we make it to the postseason.
If I were the one calling the shots here, I don't think my bullpen would look all that different. I mean, you have K-Rod in it. Like, you're assuming, what, a normal 7-man bullpen here?
I would think so.
Maybe 8? I guess 8, because you only have 4 starting pitchers. And so your bullpen's going to look, you know, you got K-Rod in it. You got Justin Wilson, Alex Wilson, Bruce Rondon would be a 4th guy. You want probably a couple more lefties and Kyle Ryan and Blaine Hardy. What does that get me to, 6?
I think that's 6.
So far. And then you take someone like, heck, I don't know, maybe put like Mike Pelfrey in there as a 7th guy. If, you know, if I'm still calling the shots here, my rotation is going to be Volander, Fulmer, Boyd, and Norris. And so you have the 7 guys, and maybe you make the 8th one like Jordan Zimmermann, I guess. Hmm. I don't know. I don't really know. I'm blanking on who else that 8th guy could be.
Yeah, I'm probably going to do exactly what you're talking about, because most of that bullpen is, I think, very, very serviceable. You talk about needing some lefties, fine, you get Blaine Hardy, you know, Kyle Ryan, one of those two to go with Justin Wilson. But yeah, I would put Pelfrey and I would put Sanchez, I think, out there. I don't know why. I just think Sanchez's stuff plays maybe a little bit better out of the bullpen than Zimmerman's might.
I mean, if you're going to your 8th guy in a playoffs in the bullpen, you're in trouble.
True, but the Tigers did need to do that in 2014, right? And Sanchez was the one who had to come out of the bullpen and kind of pick up Justin Verlander after like 5 or 6 innings.
Yeah, but that's because he had pitched well down the stretch. He wasn't really the 8th man at that point.
No, but I'm saying you could have a situation like that where you're not necessarily in trouble, but you might need someone with a little bit more of like a long relief possibility.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at like 2 innings like that, my guy would probably be Alex Wilson.
I like the fact that Sanchez gets more strikeouts. You know, then Wilson's not a real big strikeout guy. Zimmerman's not a huge strikeout guy either. And I think in the playoffs, that's kind of what you want. But then again, Sanchez is, you know, he was at one point on pace to give up like 35 home runs this year too. So who knows? That's like you said, it's assuming we make it to the postseason anyway. So we're a long way from that being a for sure thing. Although they're winning tonight.
Yeah.
It's one step closer. All right. We'll wrap that up then. Take a quick break, come back, finish up the show with our 7th inning Kvetch. There's a sale at V-Mart, and everything must go right after the break.
3 now. Here's the 2-2. Oh, boy. Curveball grabbed the outside corner. Victor not happy. Pitch that he felt went around the plate. You rarely see Victor complain. Brad Osmus better get out there quickly. Oh, and Victor got tossed.
And welcome back. We are ready to wrap things up here. 7th inning Kvetch time. We've been promising it all show long, the situation with V-Mart. Just really, really struggling down the stretch. And, you know, Brad Osmus has talked repeatedly about the fact that it's due to the knee. He's, you know, he's playing through some pain right now, and that's always been a problem. We saw that all last year. He never quite got that knee healthy. I think it was the other knee last year. But either way, when Victor does not have his legs under him, he does not perform as well. And that's what's happening now down the stretch. Unfortunately, you've got this black hole sitting right there in the cleanup spot in the lineup, and I think it's starting to cost the Tigers opportunities. I certainly saw it myself on Saturday in Cleveland. You know, when it came down to, I think bases loaded might have been the situation. Certainly runners second and third had a chance to kind of break it open, and he ended up striking out, and he doesn't do that. And it just kind of felt like that's not V-Mart, but what do you do? What do you do with him?
I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that this has been a very short stretch. It's only, you know, I mean, we're basically only looking at about 3 weeks of games here where he's, you know, he's hitting very, very poorly. He has a 190 batting average with a 281 on base percentage. He's only slugging 266 in his last 22 games. That's dating back to August 26th when they started a series against the Angels. If you look back before that, he had, think, 7 hits, including a home run and a few doubles in a series against the Twins at Target Field. And so we're looking at a very short stretch where he's been so poor that obviously things have snowballed out of control for the team. He's lost about 50, 60 points in OPS during that time because he's been so bad. But I think that the Tigers do kind of need to explore, you know, moving him out of the cleanup spot. And I think this is almost something you need to kind of explore a little bit for next year as well. Yeah, if you move him down a little bit further in the order, you're going like righty, righty, righty with Miguel Cabrera, JD Martinez, and Justin Upton. But you're already kind of doing that anyway. And so I almost wonder if you put Victor Martinez behind some of these other guys, because he's like so slow and such a clog on the base paths, is he going to be able to do a little bit more damage, drive in some of these, you know, slightly faster runners in Upton and JD Martinez? And is his production and the lineup's production as a whole going to go up a little bit by sequencing it that way?
Well, I mean, you touched on some pretty important issues there. Just the fact that he is a clog on the base paths, and it does kind of make not a lot of sense that he's been batting right behind Miguel Cabrera this whole time, because you got two slow guys now. And how many times have we seen this season? That's an easy double play target right there. Ain't nobody getting, you know, a freebie base out of that scenario. So does it help to kind of break up that clog between the two of them? But you don't necessarily want to move him up either, you know, and say, look, he's a high contact, low strikeout, you know, guy, whatever, high on base guy, but you don't want him batting leadoff.
No, definitely not. I mean, he's just so slow at this point. Like, yeah, Carlos Santana's been batting leadoff for the Indians, but, I mean, Victor Martinez is sundial slow. Like, right. It's just bad.
Yeah, Carlos Santana is not fleet of foot, but even he has managed to steal something like 5 or 6 bases this year. So the day Victor Martinez can steal 5 bases a year, then we'll consider maybe putting him in that spot. So what do you say? And then put him down like 6th, 7th?
Yeah, I mean, with Castellanos out at this point, I'd put him 6th behind JD and Justin Upton, and just kind of seeing what happens, like, with those guys getting on base at a ridiculous pace. I mean, you have Cabrera, Martinez, and Upton doing so well that if you get Victor Martinez, you know, after his, you know, what, 3-4 day spa treatment that he's about to get, if he comes back a little bit healthier and looking a little bit better, do his numbers and the kind of the offense's numbers go up because he's able to plate guys without necessarily being the clog on the bases behind or in front of Upton and Martinez?
Well, but that kind of assumes that he gets better, I guess, is the problem. As long as this knee continues to be barking at him, like I said, he's shown that when the knee hurts, he's not right, he doesn't hit right. If that doesn't go away, these are very important games that have to be won right now. If he's not right, what do you do with him? Do you move him down to, like, as low as you can in the lineup, or you just sit him and say you're
I mean,
done?
If he's really not right at this point, I think you have to sit him. And so we'll see how long he's out. In terms of like the series, or, you know, does he miss through the weekend? Does he miss a whole week? It'll be interesting to see exactly how the Tigers approach it. But I think at this point, you do kind of got to get to the point where you're looking to move him down or maybe even out of the lineup. You look at tonight's game. The Tigers used James McCann as their DH because they were facing a left-handed pitcher. And lo and behold, he hits a 3-run homer in the game. And so, you know, having that offense out of that spot, even if it's not necessarily a guy with Victor Martinez's ceiling, I think that, you know, the floor of that spot is going to be higher with some other guys at this point than it is with Vimar.
Now, we talked about a little bit earlier about the question of whether he would retire, you know, after this year, next year, will he write out the entire contract? Will he retire at any point? We can kind of revisit that, I guess, but the follow-up question is, would the Tigers be better off if he did?
I mean, maybe. One thing I want to kind of go back to a little bit with this is that because V-Mart has struggled and because some of these other guys have struggled a little bit this year, you're looking at Miguel Cabrera's run totals. From 2010 to 2014, he scored over 100 runs per year. You know, he was even up above 110 at some point, which is good for a leadoff hitter and, you know, spectacular for a guy at his position in the number 3 spot. But with V-Mart and others struggling behind him, he's only at 82 runs this year. And that's going to put him at, you know, maybe like on pace for like 85 to 90 for the year. And that's a little bit lower than that. And I think that's testament to the guys not performing as well behind him. And so I think that if you get, you know, V-Mart down in the order a little bit, maybe we can bump that run total up a little bit.
So overall, though, I mean, I think it's clear that if Victor Martinez is right and doing what he's supposed to be doing, you know, even giving us 2013 type performance, not 2015, because that was an awful year, but even what we saw in the first half of 2016, then that's a huge boost to the Tigers. I mean, I would say, obviously, they're better off with him playing, you know, being Victor than they are with him kind of retiring after this season.
Oh, I think so. Like, I mean, it really kind of all depends on the health of his knees, but, you know, for for most of the year, we've had a very productive Victor Martinez. And so, you know, if you take out these last 3 weeks, he has an OPS like 860 before this downturn. And that's a very valuable hitter and not something you're going to be able to replace very easily in the system, even if you do count on the amount of money that he'd be leaving on the table.
And that is the important point that, you know, if you want to kind of run the scenario, if he randomly retired after this season, then that is not a good thing. There is no Tigers fan that should be thinking, good, he's out of the way, we can, you know, improve. Then you got to go find somebody. And we dealt with this back in, I remember talking, you know, on this podcast in 2014 before they extended him about, you know, if they don't sign him, who's even out there that can serve, you know, Servio as a DH, who's going to want that kind of, you know, length of contract, that kind of money? That just aren't really a whole lot of DHs out there, you know, that are really any good.
Yeah, and one thing I will point out is that Martinez has played in 144 games this year. And then if you count, like, you know, 12 of the last 13 or so, that puts him up above the 150 mark. I think the Tigers might be better served by giving him a few more off days next year. You know, maybe you pick a game where you can put James McCann in there as the DH against a lefty or something like that. Or you might have Stephen Moy on the bench next year and sticking him in there for another game or two and giving Martinez some more days off. That might help keep him a little bit healthier throughout the year.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, too, as you talk about McCann possibly being someone who could kind of, you know, fill in as a DH, and I'm sure they won't do that very often because if he's not playing, they probably want to give him the day off. But who else from within just the Tigers system could kind of step into that role? Stephen Moya, you mentioned, but of course he's always been kind of a high strikeout guy. It remains to be seen if he's going to correct that, but who else would you see kind of possibly filling that role?
I mean, if we're talking kind of this like momentary rest day or whatever, it'll be interesting to see exactly what the Tigers do with like their backup catcher spot next year. But like, you know, say they had done this year, that maybe they could have given Miguel Cabrera some more days off as far as like being the DH when Victor Martinez sits. And then you put like Saul Tolomachia in at first base or something like that. You can use that DH spot to give guys like JD Martinez or Justin Upton an occasional day off their feet and see what happens there. And so I think that if the Tigers just give Martinez more days off, it might help him stay a little bit healthier going down the stretch next year.
Well, I mean, I guess, is Billy Butler available?
He got signed by the Yankees. Did you hear the Tigers like were thinking about signing Butler?
I did not hear that, and I'm also maybe not necessarily surprised by that.
Yeah, no, I mean, Ken Rosenthal had tweeted that like Butler thought he was going to the Tigers until the Yankees came in with an offer at the last minute.
Wow, like they were that close?
I guess so.
Or he was just that confused.
Maybe, I don't know. But like, yeah, Butler's been awful this year, and so I'm kind of happy that didn't happen.
Yeah, we always say, though, like the thing with him is he owns Justin Verlander, so as long as he's on the Tigers, then you don't got to worry about that. But I don't think that's – feels like that has not been the case the last year or so.
I mean, I was looking at the numbers. I wrote a post about this at Bless You Boys, and that basically since 2014, he really hasn't been that great. And with, like, the concerns you've heard, like, from things going on in the clubhouse, he was involved in that thing with, like, Danny Valencia out in Oakland.
Oh, that's right.
And then, like, after that, there were, like, all these quotes coming out of Kansas City, kind of out of the woodwork, about how he wasn't that great of a teammate and very kind of self-centered and all that. And so, you know, that's a little bit of a concern, and I'm kind of glad the Tigers were able to skirt around that, even if it was just by luck.
And for those who don't know what the hell we're talking about, it was something to do with the sponsorship, wasn't it? He ratted out Valencia or something and told his sponsors that he wasn't always wearing the product or something like that.
Yeah.
It basically almost cost him a sponsorship, or did cost him a sponsorship. Just, geez, what a dick move.
Yeah.
I'm looking now at the list now from Baseball Reference using their play index and just ranking by OPS plus, kind of getting the more, you know, universal view from the DH perspective. Victor Martinez is number 6 on that list. So he is one of the better DHs in the American League.
Yeah, I mean, and you have David Ortiz retiring after this year. I don't know where Kendrys Morales sits on that list, but he would be close, and he would kind of be, yeah, he would be like one of those V-mark type guys you could sign, but I feel like he's getting to the point where that next contract he signs is going to be a little bit too long for someone's liking.
Oh no, exactly. That's the problem with most of these names on the list. You got, like, you know, Nelson Cruz, Edwin Encarnacion, Carlos Beltran, Evan Gattis, Pedro Alvarez, Albert Pujols. These, you know, these are the guys that are going to get bigger contracts that you probably don't want to deal with. I'm not sure if they could ever. Who's even on that? Billy Butler is on the list, but barely. He's like a barely above average. for the OPS plus. So I mean, yeah, just not many options here. The far better thing is to get Victor Martinez producing at an acceptable level and not having to worry about who do you replace him with.
Yeah, and it, you know, if there is any sort of like follow up from this knee injury this year, you hope the Tigers kind of learn their lesson and give him a little bit more of a break this offseason than they did in 2015.
And tell him to stop freaking sliding into bases, because isn't that what started this whole thing? He tried to stretch something into a double, I think, and he slid weird. It was one of those situations. It was a weird slide. He came up limping. Ever since then, he's been...
Yeah.
Just stop. People complain about the fact that he doesn't run to first base. I'm like, that's good. Don't stress yourself. Those legs exactly. are going to pop any day.
Yeah.
All right. I think that is just about going to do it for another episode of The Voice of the Turtle. Rob, last words?
No, I'm trying to get out of here. Matt Boyd's pitching a gem right now, and I want to see the rest of it.
All right. Then we'll leave it at that. All right. We are one half of the conversation. You're the other half. So leave the comments at westofwoodward.com or on Twitter at hookslide23 and BYB Rob. And, of course, subscribe, rate, review the show on iTunes. And on behalf of Rob Rojacki and fatigued Tigers fans everywhere, this is Hookslide saying have a great week. Don't skip out on batting practice, and we will see you the next time on The Voice of the Turtle.